All right. So, hey, guys, it's Alex Oaks here, and this is Classic Camera Revival. Now, camera nerds, we see things. We look at things. And one thing that is prominently featured in a lot of TV series and movies these days is cameras. And first off, the bat, we actually mentioned it on our last episode about the Argus C3 and its appearance in the Harry Potter film, specifically the second one. So I got to thinking and thought, hey, you know what? Why not just do an entire episode dedicated to cameras that are featured in popular movies, old, new, or TV series? So this month, it's the summer blockbuster season, as seen on TV.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
All right, so we are going to start with probably the weirdest camera here on the table, and that would be Mike Battaxi and the Ricoh Mirai.
Yeah, the Ricoh Mirai, which was featured in Batman, of all movies. Now, the Ricoh Mirai kind of looks like, I don't know, almost like a 1980s design of a space shuttle, maybe, sort of. At the same time, it can easily be mistaken for a speed radar gun, and probably not something that you really want to be carrying around. I mean, it's kind of bulky, it's kind of heavy, it's very plasticky. However, the optics on it are absolutely fantastic. I've had phenomenal results out of it, but I just don't use it very often because it's clunky, and it doesn't feel fantastic in the hand. But it is kind of fun standing beside a roadway, pointing it down the street and watching cars as they slow down rapidly, because this thing really truly does look like a speed radar gun. So it is quite, you could almost say, stealthy looking, but there's no mistaking it. In today's day and age, there is absolutely nothing stealth about this camera.
So how was the camera featured in Batman? Now, which Batman are we talking about here?
I believe it was the original, the first Batman, Keaton and
so Jack Tim Burton. Yeah, 1980.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, perfect. The one Batman that, when you look at, didn't have nipples on the costume.
That would be 1989, if I remember correctly.
Okay, yeah. Close enough.
Yeah, it's funny how it progressed from Keaton to Clooney in a tight outfit with nipples.
Yeah. The camera really work in the film as a whole? How was it featured, first of all?
Well, you know what? And this is how the whole stealth idea comes in. Is because when you do look at it and you can see how it could be stealthy. Because actually, interesting enough, one of the unique features of this camera is the fact that it has super fast autofocus. And here's the thing. It can focus in nearly pitch black because it has a focus assist beam that it fires out that's red. And I've tested it, taking it into a closet, pointing it at something. I can't see anything, so I'm just assuming that it's in focus. And it does lock on to something in focus, which does the whole beep beep to let you know that it is in focus.
Wow. And
the fact that I'm in a pitch black closet and it found something to focus on, I was really impressed with low light feature on that thing.
Not bad. Not bad at all.
In the movie, when they used it, it was done at night in shadows. And so for that aspect, for what this camera was designed for, yeah, I would say sure. But the fact that it has a very slow lens that at its widest at 35 mil is f4, we're not going to be shooting too much at night with this camera.
No, definitely not. Not unless you put in like 3200 speed film and push it.
Yeah, you're this camera is not a evening or a nighttime shooter. Pop-up flash on it, mine doesn't work. There must be something wrong with it, but. Yep. I don't see how the pop-up flash really is going to do a whole heck of a lot at night for this thing. You could get an accessory speed light to it, but it takes a proprietary shoe specifically designed for it. And these flashes for this camera, they're few and far between.
Okay.
Because they just, it's a proprietary shoe. It's just silly why they do that.
Yeah. Not bad. It is definitely a weird looking camera with the flip out handle and
and
it almost looks like it almost looks like my very first digital camera, the D-Image Z2.
Yeah, from Minolta. I could see that. Well, the other thing is this camera was also designed as a joint venture with Olympus as well. Like, the Olympus does have one that looks very similar.
Yeah.
And this is actually the second iteration of the Mirai. The original was a 35-105. This is the 35-135.
Okay.
So it does go a little bit further as far as
the zoom probably lose a bit more on the
I don't know.
Wide open
end. I don't know. You probably do.
Okay.
But I haven't noticed too much, because one of the things that I have found that this camera really excels with is the quote-unquote macro or close-up photography, because it does. You can get pretty darn close with it. The optics when you're shooting macro, you usually stop down a little bit more, but they are phenomenally sharp. And, I mean, just looking at it, you can easily see why it could be considered almost like a speed radar gun.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice. Well, from the weird to the common, we have Bill and the Nikon F.
Thanks, Alex. A long time ago, watching Saturday Night in the Movies on TVO here in sort of Southern Ontario, they had this, they used to show classic movies, and I saw Blow Up for the first time, and it was this is a movie directed by Michelangelo Antonioni. So if you're a real cinephile, you'd recognize this man's works. Blow Up was set in the probably around 1967 London, sort of on the tail end of the mod era, and it stars David Hemmings as this unnamed photographer, very successful, lives in this really groovy loft where he was shooting with a Hasselblad 500C, which we're not talking about because we've talked about that camera to death. But he also shot with a Nikon F. With the non-metered prism head, which is sort of the really classic iteration. And at the time when I first saw it, I was more into the sort of like the whole style of it, because I was also at that point in time, I was into sort of like Blur, the Stone Roses, and other Britpop bands in the late 80s, early 90s. So when I got into more deeper into photography, I kind of appreciated the character and what he was up to. And the whole plot of the movie was Hemmings' character, the photographer, stumbles into Hyde Park with his Nikon F. He was just shooting for his personal portfolio, and he stumbles across a murder scene. So he shoots it. I believe it's like, I think it was Nikon F with the 105 2.5 lens, which...
Beautiful lens.
Which we'll talk about in a later episode. And, of course, over the course, he goes into his on-site work dark room in his loft, which I really want his loft, by the way. Because who wouldn't? Like, a nice loft, 60s vintage London? Like, what's not to like? Anyway, so you see him, he's sort of blowing up the doing enlargements, and then it was coming to the point, he notices, oh, wow, a dead body. And then Vanessa Redgrave sort of comes along saying, yeah, I'd like to buy the negatives and the prints off you. And it goes from there. So how does the camera become part of the film? Well, it's one of the character's primary tools, aside from using his medium format work for shooting fashion. He was shooting documentary on his Nikon F, and that's what he was doing throughout a fair chunk of the movie in the middle part, where he was sort of wandering around London's West End and then into Hyde Park. So, yeah. If you get a chance to see this film, watch it. It's a fun movie for photography geeks and non-photography geeks.
So what do you like about the Nikon F?
Oh, talking to someone who owns two eye-level prism Fs, one TN meter head and one FTN meter head. Yeah, well,
so you don't like it very much then?
It's one of those... It's the classic pro body. Actually, it's the groundbreaking camera body that buried Leica. And to a lesser extent, Frank and Heidecke with Rolleiflex, because a lot of the working pros thought, wow, interchangeable sort of platform, basically everything.
Yeah, it became the first modular system camera.
Yeah. And it sort of solidified that with the working professionals and made Nikon the brand of choice up until about, I guess, the 1980s.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, gosh, I would say it was probably the first crossroads in photography technology.
With autofocus.
Yeah, so that's when you started to see, I guess, the purist versus, I don't know what you'd call them, non-purists, I suppose. So you have like the Leica heads,
yep,
or Leica files, who everything is pure, manual, no meter, and that still exists today with a lot of the Leica cameras. You have your classic Leica people, and then you have your modern Leica people. Mm-hmm. So there's even a bifurcation in there. But I think it's really true, though. It's such an interesting point that that was revolutionary. Like, that was the first real viable SLR platform.
Pretty much. It was for Nikon's answer to the D5 at that time. Mm-hmm. So, again, it was not a cheap camera body. So you had mostly working professional photojournalists and commercial photographers were the ones buying them.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Nikon F has shown up in multiple movies as well, not only Blow Up, but
And all its variants as well, too, have been all over the place.
Like, I've seen them in the Full Metal Jacket. I've seen it in...
It's been in the Bang Bang Club.
Yeah.
You owe me a beer.
Pretty much.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. Well, staying on the crime genre, the camera I want to talk about is one that we have brought up before. But that would be the Exacta, the VX, and that appeared in Alfred Hitchcock's classic Rear Window, which is also one of the first movies that my wife and I first watched together. Actually, it was on one of our first dates with actually watching a couple of Alfred Hitchcock classics. The one with the hotel. What is that one?
Psycho.
That's rather kind of creepy as a first date. First you watch Psycho and then Rear Window, well, so you've got a weird peeping Tom looking.
The first thought that came to my mind was that Alex is pretty slick. Like, first date, he's got already Netflix and chill on
right?
First date. How would that happen?
Actually, she suggested it.
Yeah, just to confirm.
Well done, sir. Well done.
You're not so old that you saw them as premieres in the theater.
No, we watched them on DVD.
You're not 80 years old.
No. If I was, I look good. So, the camera really is one of the central characters in the movie itself, being the window in which Jimmy Stewart's character, who is immobilized because of a broken leg in a wheelchair, which is why I think the Exacta is the perfect camera for it. Now, I've used this camera before, and it has all the controls flipped from what we are so normally, but if you're sitting in a wheelchair, it doesn't really matter because you're not moving. You also have this massive telephoto lens on it, and with your leg up, it gives you the perfect way to, you know, rest everything, or on a tripod, the camera really, it really doesn't matter that you're on it. Now, if you're walking around, again, the waist level finder makes it so much easier to use. But at an eye level finder, the camera is super super awkward to use, especially if you're so used to the normal right-handed way of doing things. And in that case, I think the camera works brilliantly in the film and really shows that even immobilized, a photographer still is the master of observation and can watch and see these things, which makes truly, in my mind, the camera the center character in the film, more so than the actual people. So, I would one day love to add one of the cameras to my collection. Even in an unworking state, it would make a great shelf queen because it just looks fantastic.
I think
I'll give you one.
You can not that one.
Yeah.
One that is of lesser quality than that one.
That's fine. That would be great. Thank you.
Alex getting a free camera.
On air.
A shocker.
Well, I mean,
wait a minute. Did I just admit I'm part of the problem?
I think we're all part of the problem, and that's why we're doing an episode about this later.
Well, you know what's funny is the Exacta is definitely not an angry person's camera. You have to be pretty calm and composed when you use that camera because
it's backwards.
It's not only that, when it screws up, it screws up large, and if you, it's very easy to get angry with this style camera because it's very frustrating to use, and it gives you no feedback. I think that was one of your mentions on it was it gives no feedback
when you're feedback.
So it's a camera for Buddhists,
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. Yes. Yeah, you have to be pretty calm and collected. Yep. And you know what? When you look at this camera, it kind of has that feeling of calm, collect, like a really calm and
aesthetically, serene. It's one of the like coolest looking cameras.
It is
like,
a beautiful
it's
camera.
Just like,
it's beautiful.
It's hard to believe that it was in communist-controlled Germany.
Yeah, what is it? Circa, like, it's the 40s era, right?
Yeah.
Mid-30s, mid-40s?
Well, I mean, this one is...
It probably says made in East Germany.
It says it's occupied. Germany, USSR occupied, which is just... As a history nerd, that's so cool to get cameras that actually say that. Yeah. A few Nikons actually said U.S. occupied Japan.
And that is the...
This is the VX2A.
Yeah, so that's the North American version of the camera.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was the VX that appeared in Rear Window. But again, there are very few changes between the different models.
Yeah,
so.
they're such lovely cameras. When you can use them, they are such lovely cameras.
Oh, yeah. Interestingly, in the movie, Jimmy Stewart actually uses the camera in reverse. And those that haven't seen this camera before, the shutter release is actually on the left-hand side.
Yep.
And that's why we say reverse, as is the film advance lever as well. So all of the typical controls that you would find on most SLR bodies that would be on the right hand, so where the grip is, and you know, mostly made for right-handed folks. If you're a southpaw, this is a camera for you.
Yeah,
except rewinding. The rewinding.
Have you actually shot it, John?
Yeah, well, I actually used to have one, and exactly, I think I sold it to Mike.
Yeah,
and yes, I'm left-handed, but the problem is, first of all, people who are left-handed are very naturally flexible and adaptable, as well as very intelligent.
Makes sense.
What are you trying to put us all down here?
No, I'm just trying to stay fact based.
As a fellow left-hander, I tend to agree with John.
Yeah, well, I mean, lefties is kind of the minority, so everything is more geared towards right-handed. So it makes perfect sense.
To finish my point, I found it just as strange to use because as a right-hander because I'm just so used to shooting right-handed cameras.
Yeah, makes sense.
But boy, it's a beautiful. Like one of these days, I would love to get one of their first, like their 127 format, the VP Exacta. Mm-hmm. That is the most aesthetically beautiful camera ever made.
That example that you have there has got a very beautiful original Biotar on there.
Yeah.
For those that are fans of the
Helios
44 F2, that is a Biotar design, and on this camera is an actual Biotar.
Yeah. Beautiful lens. And the other camera that is absolutely gorgeous is the larger model, the Exacta 66. Not the more modern one.
Yes.
But the classic design.
Yep.
What a stunning camera that one is.
Oh, yeah.
It's like anyone that's interested in vintage cameras really do need to explore Exacta. It's probably one of the It's probably one of the best priced antique cameras you can find because it's so obscure. That you have to be, like, you got to be, you know, a solid camera nerd to appreciate it. So
absolutely.
And we have a bunch of them at the table here today. So
yeah. Well, we're sticking with death. And we have John with the classic Kodak Retina. And it was featured in the film Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yep, and I'll be honest, I saw the film when it came out in 1994. Like, my goodness, that's almost a quarter century ago.
Yes.
Time flies. And it did not feature prominently. In fact, I'm trying to remember exactly where it was, but I'm told it is in the movie.
Because it's not a Voigtlander.
It is not a Voigtlander.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
Voigtlander prominent, people.
Oh.
So, come on.
Ooh.
All right, I'll shut up.
Ooh,
now.
Hiss. Hiss. You know, James, you can be funny, and then there's now. sorry. I'm trying to remember, like, the thing is, I have the 2A, which is one of the older ones. Like, the Retina had a long run. Like in
huge.
One, so my guess is probably in the movie, they probably had something like a 3C, one of the newer. But even then, that's in 1990s. That was pretty.
It's still featuring an old rangefinder. Yeah.
And like the Retinas are beautiful cameras. They're it's like, you know, a Fabergé egg that can take pictures.
Yeah.
Because it is so finely crafted. Strictly, you know, the lens of Schneider Retina Xenon. Beautiful glass.
Yep.
It's a folder, so it folds up very, very compact. Does not take a lot of space. And people like them, but my personal view, and I don't use this camera all that much, is that ergonomically it is not great.
No.
It is, like, it's designed for Tinkerbell. It's, the controls are so small.
It's tiny.
The rangefinder, the window is squinty, and especially if you wear glasses, like a lot of us at this table do, it is just...
All but one.
It is unpleasant. But it's an amazing example of German engineering. Also, they can tend to be rather fragile, especially, yes. I think it was the Model 3, I think, where they decided to enhance or modernize the film wind shutter cocking mechanism and created a bit of a weak spot. So this is not, like you were talking before about, this is not a camera to use angry. This is especially not a camera to use angry. You need to basically handle it with kid gloves.
Yeah. Well, that only leaves us one, and I've saved this one for last because the film came out quite recently. And if you haven't had a chance to see it, I highly recommend you do. Not just for the subject matter as camera nerds, but just as it's a fabulous film, well written, well acted, lots of couple of big names in it, and that film is of course Kodachrome, which celebrates the journey to take rolls of Kodachrome to Duane's photo in Parsons, Kansas, to have them process it before they shut down Kodachrome processing forever. And I mean, I shot several rolls before it all ended, and just like, oh man, I wish I'd gotten to this film sooner, but...
Don't we all?
Well...
Yeah, that's my one big regret, not shooting more Kodachrome.
Wish I shot more Kodachrome.
Yep.
Yeah, I wish I got a chance to shoot it.
I wish I never stopped shooting it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's all come to an end unless you're some crazy
guy. You don't appreciate it till it's gone.
Yep. Yeah.
But, well, I think it was appreciated while it was here. But
It was. But.
And, well, the camera we have for you today wasn't actually in the film... No. It is still a Leica, and to present it, we have James.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about the Leica M6, and the M6 didn't actually appear in Kodachrome. It was an M4P, but the M6 has been in a ridiculous amount of movies and lots of different cameos. The movie Kodachrome was actually also shot, I believe, on Kodak Vision 3 film as well. So. Shot on film. If it wasn't Vision 3, it was certainly one of the current Kodak motion picture films. So.
Well, they have three fantastic films in the Vision line, the 50D, the 250D, and the 800T.
Yeah, the motion picture film industry is still going strong, thankfully.
Yep.
But the movie Kodachrome was, it was based on a 2010 New York Times article, actually, by A.G. Sulzberger. Who basically wrote this article to document the, I guess, pilgrimage to Duane's photo in Parsons, Kansas in 2010 when Kodak announced that, they were going to sunset Kodachrome. They had basically shipped out to Duane's sometime in probably 08 or 09 a year's worth of dyes and chemicals.
Yeah.
To just continue shooting. And this was after several, like, I think there were probably about 26 plants around the world that used to process Kodachrome.
So just so that everyone knows, Kodachrome, the Kodachrome process is wildly different from all other slide film processes, which we know today as E6. Kodachrome itself is a black and white film at its very core, which each emulsion layer is chemically bonded to a dye, though the color is actually introduced in the processing. It's long, it's complex, and terrible for the environment.
Yeah. And if you do have Kodachrome today, film that is, you can actually process it in black and white. So there's a few different formulas out there. A lot of people are using HC110, Xtol.
Or if you're crazy enough, you actually develop Kodachrome as color. Yeah. And one of our previous episodes, like,
our friend
Kelly Shane Fuller,
who's doing it out of his home as a mad scientist.
Yeah,
so I have yet to send him a roll, but I think I will. I have a few rolls kicking around still, 9 of them, I think. They're in the deep freeze, so who knows? Maybe I'll send Kelly an email and see if we can get some of that processed. But moving on to the M6, so it's been in a lot of different movies. It's been in Addicted to Love, the 1997 Meg Ryan bounces around with it with a 35 Kron on it. The Caveman's Valentine, which is an obscure movie from 2001. Samuel Jackson gets his picture taken by art photographer Colm Feore with an M6. In 2004, Julia Roberts uses a motorized M6 TTL to photograph Natalie Portman, which I'm kind of sad about because I would much rather be photographing Natalie Portman.
The guys at this table would love to be photographing Natalie Portman.
Yeah, and I have an M6. It's not a TTL, but so, you know, I can get the job done. Alas. And then, of course, there was Spy Game with Brad Pitt, and that was like an abomination because what they did was they dubbed over a motor drive like Nikon FE or something while he was shooting the basically silent M6 in that movie. So, you know, thank you, Hollywood. But anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Kodachrome, the movie, and M6. And I really, you know, Kodachrome is such an incredible movie. I've watched it. Gosh, probably about 5 or 6 times already on Netflix. And if you haven't watched it, you really should. It's not a camera geek movie. It's more of a photographer's movie, yes. I think. And it's not about the gear, but it's about the mindset of a photographer. And
yeah, we're nuts.
And kind of like, you know, when you know, without art, I guess without pain, you really can't have really expressive art, I guess, is one of the premises in the movie, which kind of spoke to me because, I mean, I think, like, as photographers, we're all observers, and the reason why no two images will ever be the same is because it's based on individual perspective. And then, you know, what's been your experience up until the point you've taken that photo? Also, what happened to you that day? Did you wake up on the right side, wrong side of the bed? Did something happen that day? All of those things play influences in how you capture an image. So if you're into that sort of deconstruction of art and what it takes to see things, I highly recommend taking a look. But the M6 itself. So I think the M6 for me is the best in the M lineup for Leica cameras, and I'll tell you why. The M2s, you know, beautiful but old. Has a vertical film rewind. It's a pain in the ass, you know, to load and to rewind your film. The M3, you know, was really a huge step up in the engineering and the making of that camera. There's no 35 millimeter frame lines. I mean, you know, this is a street photographer's camera, and you know, you want to have those 35 millimeter frame lines.
Actually, like the geek here, actually the M3 came first, then the M2.
Yes. This is not chronological. I'm doing this in M
order. Numerical order.
Numerical order.
Fair enough.
But yeah.
James speak.
Yeah.
James Logic,
yes. The M4 has no meter, so if I'm going to spend a couple of grand on a body, I want a bloody meter for crying out loud. And you know what? Shooting a Leica is not a speedy endeavor. So, you know, I mean, it's you can do Sunny 16, you can do all that stuff. That's great. Like, I'm totally fine with that. But if I'm going to spend Leica money, is going to have a meter in the camera, not on the camera.
If I'm going to spend Leica money, I'm going to buy a Hasselblad.
Yeah. Of course, then there's the MPs that came out. I mean, yeah, I'd love to have an MP. Do I really want to spend $4,000 on a film body?
No.
No, I don't. I mean, I would if I had it, but, you know. And the MP, in my opinion, and I've never owned one, so I can't really give you a real life, but what I've read about it, they're built to such exacting standards that you jostle it the wrong way, you bump it the wrong way, boom, CLA. Like, you know, they require some pretty serious maintenance. So I really think the M6 is sort of the pinnacle of all of the M bodies because of the shooting experience, really. And you know what? It's expensive enough, but it's not too expensive. And it's really, really dependable. Like, I've never had an issue with mine. It just keeps on going and going and going. It's easy to load. It's got a really clean viewfinder.
Says the person who once struggled for an entire day trying to load his M6.
And I'm speaking relative to other M bodies, but it is actually one of the easiest M bodies to load. Now, I will say that if you're loading any, like a polyester-based film, like any of the Rollei films, it can be a little bit of a pain in the rear end because the film stock itself is very, very thin. So, and the, you know, getting the take up, still the old style, like triple forked take up spool in the body, and you got to kind of wind it a little bit to get it in there. So, but you know what? It's tough. It's got a zinc alloy top plate, so it's not a brass plate. Mine's an M6 titanium. Which doesn't in with Leica, it's just titanium paint. Sadly, it's not actually a titanium body. But
you figure for Leica money, you'd get
titanium. You know what? If Leica put titanium in that body, could you imagine what it would cost if it was actual titanium?
Well, maybe they have a titanium screw in there.
Somewhere. Yeah, possibly.
Now, one question about the loading: do you still have to cut down the leader?
No.
On this
camera, you do not.
Revolutionary.
Yeah, you know, for me, I refer to this camera as my Timex. It takes a licking and keeps on clicking, so I didn't steal the entire Timex tagline there. It just keeps on going. You know, you can really work one of these cameras, you know, like it's lightweight. It's like an extension of your hand. Like everything's kind of in the right spot there. And look, you have to get used to it. The shutter is extremely quiet. You can shoot about anywhere. It's well balanced with a Summicron on it. I have a Summilux on it, and I have a titanium Summilux 35 on this camera, which has a brass helicoid. So it's a little bit nose heavy with the Summilux on it. But if you put the Summicron 50 or the King of Bokeh, the Summicron 35 on this camera, it's so well balanced. It's nice. Just a pleasure to use.
Yeah, I agree. I shot it with I borrowed it once and with the Summicron 50 on there.
Yeah, and that I actually have since sold that Summicron lens. So that was a version 3 Summicron. That was on that camera before. I actually sold that when I bought my M240 and bought the updated version 5 Kron, which actually is even nicer balance on this camera. So build quality, again, like I said, is superb. You know, you get into some debates with some of the real Leica fanboys that are just enamored with the M3. The M6, interestingly, has a little bit of a manufacturing history that I guess you can be aware of. So they were made essentially in two cities. There's the Wetzlar version and there's the Solms version. So the Wetzlar version is the more classic M3, and then the later model, M6 rather, and then the later model M6s were made in Solms, and the TTL was also made in Solms. So there is a TTL version of this. They're both TTL metering. The TTL version of the M6 has a different, actually I think is a better placed, ergonomically placed film speed knob, and it's a little bit bigger than the classic M6. Some people say that the Solms version are a little bit better than the Wetzlar's, but I think there's like very little that you would really notice. Some key differences is the Wetzlar version had a different meter circuit, which basically had a shorter cutoff time. So basically, it's 9 seconds in the early version and 11 seconds in the later version. So at some point, the Wetzlar ones, the cutoff time was increased, and then like they changed the little exposure triangles a little bit in the middle. There's really not too much of a difference. You know, I wouldn't. I think the Solms version, if I was going to buy one today, like if I was going to recommend anyone to buy one, that'd be the one I would go for. Simply because, like, I'm a firm believer in buy these cameras to shoot them. Now, if you're a collector, fine, get the Wetzlar version because you're buying it for a totally different reason. You're buying it to be a shelf clean and to talk about it. But
I mean, if you're spending that much money on a fairly modern camera, why would you let it be a shelf clean?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's wrong.
It's wrong. And you can tell the difference between the two versions. If you look at the top plate, mine says Leica Camera GmbH Germany, which indicates that it's a Solms camera.
Right.
If it was a Wetzlar, it would have said Leitz Wetzlar Germany.
Right.
And there was some rumor that, you know, us as Canadians should talk about this, considering it is Canada Day today.
Yep.
There was some rumor that some of the M6 bodies were manufactured in the Canadian plant up here in Milton, but...
Midland.
In Midland. Did I say, what did I say?
Milton.
Oh, Milton. No, we're in Milton.
Recording in Milton.
We're recording in Milton.
Yeah, that's the topic pardon me, for yes, a whole
Midland,
other show.
Yeah, Midland, Ontario, and... they actually never did. They just manufactured optics up there.
Yeah.
So,
which is why they still manufacture the companies now owned by General Dynamics, and they manufacture the Elcan scope, which is used by
the military,
by the Canadian Army on the C7 and C8 carbines. Mm-hmm. And Elcan stands for Ernst Leitz Canada, and very iconic scope if you've seen it. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, you know what? The Solms, like, I would go for that because there are electronic components in this camera, and if you're going to buy an electronic camera, buy the latest one that you can buy because it's got... It generally, as a general rule, will have improvements over previous versions, so definitely. Try not to be an early adopter when it comes to ancient electronics, I guess.
Yep.
Or current ones, for that matter, too. I think, you know what, that said, they're both equally as reliable in the research I've done and other cameras that I've seen and used. A little thing to note, so those that are getting into the Leica market, there are three different finder magnifications. So there's a standard 0.72 magnification. This is the viewfinder I'm talking about. So it has frame lines for 28, 90, and 35, and 135 and 50 millimeter frames. And then there's the optional 58 time, which deletes the 135 millimeter frame. And then there's the optional 85, which deletes the 28. That is kind of an uncommon focal length for Leica. You know, I know Minolta, the Rokor made 28. I'm sure there's a 28 out there as well, like an Elmarit or an Elmar or something like that. But you know, in terms of construction, it's solid. It's in terms of usability. You know, 1 second to 1,000th. Flash sync speed is 1/50th of a second, which is slow, but you know,
that's really
it's
slow.
In between 30 and 60, and it's rated at 1/50th of a second. But it's weird. Like, I don't know, but that's Leica for you, I guess. But you know what? I'd love to tell you there's some major flaws with this camera, but there really isn't. It's really a well-designed, really well-built camera. It's not, I mean, it's expensive, but it's not overly expensive. It's extremely well-made. And if you, it's really, if you're a rangefinder person, if you're a rangefinder shooter, that's the camera that you want.
Awesome. Well, sticking on the topic of moving pictures, if you've been living under a rock, you probably haven't heard of Film Ferrania restarting up production over in Italy. And they came in with a very bold Kickstarter campaign to bring back a slide film, which is very difficult to do. I mean, we still haven't seen Kodak Ektachrome, the new version, yet, but hopefully this year, and we definitely will be touching on the new Ektachrome once it's released, and we've all had a chance to shoot for it. But Ferrania, and you know what? I'm going to give them credit. They're planning on doing a very difficult thing. They're facing a lot of difficulty, if you've read any of their updates. A lot of red tape, a lot of bureaucracy. But to their credit, they did bring back one thing, and from the sounds of it, it was completely by accident. And that is P30. Now, P30 is something that has been a past product for the original Ferrania brand. Motion picture film, red sensitive, just an absolutely gorgeous film. And most of us have had a chance to shoot it. So we just wanted to talk about it now that it's actually bright and sunny here in southern Ontario for the few weeks that it is. So yeah,
it's only like +40 outside right now. It's disgusting. Yes. Right now.
Yeah. 40 as in centigrade, not Fahrenheit.
Yeah, so that's like what, 110?
Yeah.
But yeah, we're experiencing Florida weather.
Yeah. Apparently, no. It's actually, I saw something. It's going to be, it's hotter today in Toronto and the GTA than it is in Egypt.
Oh. Holy actually, God. I got a friend of mine who's vacation visiting family in Jordan. And it's cooler at a Dead Sea resort in Jordan than it is here in southern Ontario.
Wow.
Hot. Man's
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Hotter than Egypt, that really Sphinx.
Yeah. Meanwhile,
global warming is a hoax, right?
Wow.
Climate change. Climate change.
It's climate change. Anyway, should I talk about my P30
yeah,
experience?
Absolutely.
Okay. I did not take part in the, I sort of didn't buy any P30. Alex sort of fronted me a box of P30, and bear in mind my experiences are from this single box. Like generally, if I want to talk about a film, I want to shoot about 5-6 rolls, then I can give you a more, you know, in-depth opinion. I loaded it into a recently overhauled Olympus OM2N, and I went out to down to Port Dalhousie on a what looked like a rather miserable morning, and even then the film performed beautifully. I processed it, and again, Phil Piranha, the folks there suggest strongly D76 or it's
motion, D96
or a D96. I was too lazy to mix up D76, and of course I didn't have any D96 lying about, but I had some HC110. Now, of course, they tell you you agitate very gently for the first 30 seconds and then one inversion every minute. So I followed that to the letter, and I got with some great nags. Now, granted, my inversions were nice and slow. A lot of people out there are kind of think, hey, film processing is a lot like making a martini. No, it is not. And I was quite happy with it. It's a very easy Ferrania P30 is very easy to scan, and you can pull stuff out in Lightroom, shadow detail that you couldn't readily get. Would I shoot more of it? Yes, of course. And I hope they do a much bigger run next time, and hopefully the price per roll comes down a bit. Because I think the one Achilles heel is $8 US roll plus shipping from Italia. You're kind of competing with, I think, Japan Camera Hunter Street Pan 400 when you land it. And so you're looking at
price
maybe...
Price-wise, anyway.
Yeah, price-wise, I think you're probably in the same neck of the woods. And there's a lot of 100 ISO speed black and white film floating around out there. Now, granted, is it is as good as P30 in that sort of slow range? Well, no. But I think P30 for some applications might even be a nice replacement for Acros 100. And I said some applications. I wouldn't try night photography with it.
Yeah, we just have no reciprocity failure information on P30. Now, I've had a chance to shoot quite a bit of P30. I bought into the original Film Ferrania Kickstarter, and when they said, hey, look, we can't do slide film just yet, and I'm kind of like, do I really want to wait? I'm like, no, I don't. So I switched to the P30 and ended up with 4 rolls. And then I waited, and 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 finally I got the email saying, hey, look, your film has shipped. I'm like, fantastic, 4 rolls right off the bat.
Well, if it's any consolation, I'm still waiting for my slide film.
Yes, they still have not produced a slide film. There's, like I said, they're dealing with a lot of nonsense, and you know what?
You think our government's bad.
I do give them one thing. They have stuck it out, and I mean, they might go into moments of silence. If you follow them on social media, they have a great Instagram feed. They go silent for months at a time, and I mean, it's the same to be said for Silbera. But you know what? It's the risk you take when you go and back someone on crowdfunding campaigns. Like we mentioned earlier, they do highly recommend either D76 or D96, which is a motion picture developer. And again, I've shot it in HC110, and I followed their agitation pattern and then promptly decided not to. I do the standard agitation constant for a minute, then 10 seconds every minute thereafter. And you know what? I get great results. D76 is the perfect developer. Now, D76 is not known for being fine grain, very normal developing pattern. There's nothing exciting about it. But then you put P-30 through D-76, and the results are incredible. Now, I've since looked up the formula to make my own D-96, and I definitely plan on hitting up Photographer's Formulary and making my own D-76 from scratch and seeing what it does with the film. But D-76 is absolutely incredible. You get rich tones, next to no grain. And just you really see the extended range sensitivity. Even with a yellow filter, you get the deep black in the sky, and just absolutely incredible. Now, they also have published the now the film normally is an ASA 80 film, and they also have ASA 50 film. So I've pulled it, and the one thing I do have to say is you need to filter it if you pull it. Because the first about 5-6 frames of the roll I shot were completely and totally overexposed, and I followed the published developing times, and just there was not enough there to even recover. But as soon as I slapped a yellow 15 deep yellow filter on it, I immediately got stunning results out of the film, and I'm so glad I bought a second brick of 10 rolls, which I've divvied up to a few people in the room to shoot and play with. But no, I highly recommend the film. It's sort of like the best of both the Eastman 5363 and Rolly Retro 80S, because
that's a great comparison.
It has the thicker base, mm-hmm. which you get with the Eastman, and the red sensitivity you get out of Retro 80S.
Well, I just think like that in the tonality and the contrast are that the combination of those two films. Yeah, it gets
you get a rich chrome.
Yeah, look. Yeah. There's very little grayscale, like gray tones in it. I find like it's. I mean, obviously there are gray tones in it,
yeah.
But in terms of mid tones, like I don't think there's too much mid tone gray in it. Like it's black and white essentially. Yep. You know. And I like for like grungy street photography, high contrast look with
definitely
good mid tones, not the same, I guess. I don't know what you'd say, but you know, variations in gray tones. Mm. There's very little, the less variations in the middle gray tones than there are, but the two ends are
incredibly
very contrasty,
cinematic.
Yeah,
there are some developer combinations that you should stay away from. I decided to try it. You know, it's not that high speed of film. Let's try it with Rodinal.
Oh, Hayes Rodinal.
Yeah, it's of course it's sharp as all hell. It'll cut your eyeballs. But
the funny thing is, I found it quite soft in Rodinal.
I found it sharp. I found it especially in any kind of frame that had a lot of large like tonal areas. Let's say like a sky or something, the grain just screamed at me.
Mm.
I also tried it in Microdoll X. There is no published time since Microdoll X you can't get anymore. And fairly contrasty. I think if I were to try it again and juice up the development time, there might be something there. Mm. My favorite so far has been T-Max.
Yeah, that's
the developer.
I was just going to say that shot over there, that's T-Max.
Yeah, so I still have one or two rolls left, so I think when I shoot it next, I'll be going with the T-Max. But I think further to Bill's point, it is not a cheap film.
Ew.
And that's a bit of a concern.
Well, you know, again, in Ferrania's defense, they are basically bringing a film company, a film manufacturing company back from the dead. Now, granted, they're also butting heads with local and regional Italian bureaucracy, which can be, you know, a challenge at the best of times. But and again, it's also the size of their production run. If anyone's noticed with the Japan Camera Hunter Street Pan, yeah, the first run, yeah, that was not a cheap roll of film. But
no.
The subsequent runs have gotten cheaper because more was made. So again, I sincerely, you know, and again, I've sort of maybe slagged a little Ferrania a little bit for, you know, maybe shooting too far towards the moon with the slide film, and they probably should have said, hey, let's bring back a black and white film from a storied black and white motion picture.
Remind
stock.
You of any company that starts with a K and ends with a K?
Yeah, maybe.
Bring back Plus X, Kodak.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Mr. Lee, especially 120. But getting back to Ferrania, hopefully once they get their plant up and running, they can do a much, much bigger run and hopefully get that price per roll down to, like, say, maybe $6 U.S. per roll.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they'll have an HIT on their hands.
Well, the film is lovely.
Oh, yeah. And actually, if you go and take a look at our episode notes, we'll have several examples online of some of the great stuff that that the folks around the table have actually shot. Well, that about covers it for this episode. My name's Alex Oak, saying instead of going to a movie theater and watching a summer blockbuster, get outside and make your own.
This is John Meadows. Shoot a film camera. You could be a star.
This is James Lee. Stop watching film and start shooting it.
This is Mike Bataxi, and I want to do a special shout-out to my good friend, Ori Carmona. Congratulations on the new edition.
Absolutely.
Woohoo! Yeah, congratulations, Ori. This is Bill Smith. I want to say hi to my friend Mike Gutterman down in Louisville, Kentucky, with his Negative Positives photography podcast. And again, it's sunny outside. Go ahead and shoot some film.
And this is Donna Bataxi. Congratulations, Ori, and happy Canada Day, and get out there and start shooting some film.